This CLE course is based on the New York State appellate decisions released in June of 2019 that addressed criminal law issues. The summaries that make up the written materials here were originally posted on the website New York Appellate Digest in June of 2019, and subsequently they've been collected into an organized update pamphlet. And it is that June 2019 criminal law update pamphlet, which functions as the written material for this CLE course. The first case we're going to look at in the June 2019 criminal law update pamphlet is on page 12. It's People versus Washington. It has to do with the appealability of a particular issue. Fourth Department noted that appellate review of a court's determination of the sufficiency of the evidence presented to the grand jury is not reviewable upon appeal of a conviction based upon legally sufficient trial evidence. The way the court put it, county court's determination with respect to the legal sufficiency of the evidence before the grand jury is not reviewable upon an appeal from an ensuing judgment of conviction based upon legally sufficient trial evidence. Next on pages 12 and 13 is People versus Lauman or Lohman. It has to do with the viability of an arrest based on a warrant. Fourth Department noted that the fact that the statutory speedy trial period had expired at the time the bench warrant was executed did not invalidate the arrest for resisting arrest. The court wrote, "The fact that the statutory speedy trial period had expired on the charge underlying the bench warrant did not vitiate the warrant's facial validity and thereby negate the officer's authority to execute it for purposes of the resisting arrest statute. It is well established that an officer's authority to arrest does not hinge on the ultimate success of the underlying prosecution, if any." Next, on page 13, is Matter of Davis. It has to do with whether an Article 78 proceeding is appropriate in a criminal matter. Third Department held that petitioner must seek review of the denial of a motion to dismiss an indictment pursuant to CPL 40.40 by direct appeal and not by the instant Article 78 action for prohibition or mandamus with respect to the district attorney and the judge. The petitioner had moved to dismiss the indictment on the ground that the people had legally sufficient evidence to support the indictment at the time he pled guilty to a prior indictment, and that would invalidate the indictment under Criminal Procedure Law 40.40. County Court denied that motion without a hearing, even though County Court noted it couldn't determine whether the people had legally sufficient evidence at the time the petitioner pled guilty. The court wrote, "The district attorney contends that petitioner may not obtain collateral review of county court's denial of his motion through a CPLR Article 78 proceeding, and we agree. Neither of the extraordinary remedies of prohibition nor mandamus lies as a means to obtain collateral review of an alleged error of law, particularly where, as here, there's an adequate remedy at law by way of direct appeal. Any error in county court's decision denying petitioner's motion to dismiss the indictment without a hearing is at most a mere error of law that does not justify the invocation of the extraordinary remedies sought." Next on page 14, People versus Palmer. It's a attorney conflict of interest case. Third Department, reversing defendant's conviction, held that the public defender's office represented both the defendant and the confidential informant, creating a conflict of interest. Although the issue was apparently not preserved, the appellate court considered the issue in the interest of justice. The court said an actual conflict exists if an attorney simultaneously represents clients whose interests are opposed, and in such situations, reversal is required if the defendant does not waive the actual conflict. In contrast, a potential conflict that is not waived by the accused requires reversal only if it operates on or affects the defense. Here the people concede that the public defender's office was simultaneously representing both defendant and the confidential informant during the pendency of this criminal action, and defendant and the confidential informant had opposing interests. Inasmuch as defendant never waived the conflict, reversal of the judgment is warranted. Next on pages 14 and 15, People v. James, Second Department, held that a statement that the defendant made to his mother about needing the assistance of an attorney should not have been admitted. The court wrote, "We agree with the defendant that Supreme Court should not have admitted into evidence a statement the defendant made to his mother during a recorded telephone call that involved him invoking his right to counsel. During the telephone call, the defendant said that with the assistance of an attorney, he could get around the fact that he had touched the gun earlier in the day." The court went on to say, "It has long been the rule in this state that once a criminal proceeding has formally commenced, the accused has an absolute constitutional and statutory right to the assistance of counsel at every stage of the proceeding. Accordingly, evidence which has the jury infer guilt from the fact that a criminal defendant exercised his or her right to counsel should not be admitted. Here, the admission of this statement was an improper infringement on defendant's exercise of his right to counsel." So it was deemed an error in that case, but under the facts of the case, it was also deemed a harmless error. Next, on page 15, People v. Disla. It's an ineffective assistance case. First Department held defendant received ineffective assistance of counsel. Counsel did not inform defendant he would be subject to mandatory deportation based upon his plea to an aggravated felony. The court said, "Defendant should be afforded the opportunity to move to vacate his plea upon a showing that there's a reasonable probability he would not have pleaded guilty had he been made aware of the deportation consequences of his plea, and we hold the appeal in abeyance for that purpose. While defendant requests that his conviction be replaced by a conviction under a different subdivision of the penal law that may entail less onerous immigration consequences, we find that to be an inappropriate remedy, and we instead order a hearing." Next is People v. Lopez Mendoza. It's out of the Court of Appeals. It's an ineffective assistance case, but the court found that the record was insufficient and determined that a 440 motion and a hearing would be necessary to flesh out the record. It was a full opinion by Judge Wilson over a dissent. The Court of Appeals determined, one, the record was insufficient to demonstrate defendant did not receive effective assistance of counsel, and two, it decided an evidentiary issue because the DNA evidence was not offered to identify the defendant. Any error in introducing it was harmless. With respect to the ineffective assistance, the defendant argued defense counsel didn't review the surveillance video the people provided and pursued a theory at trial that was at odds with the video evidence. In addition, defense counsel told the jury in his opening statement that defendant wouldn't testify or would testify, but he didn't testify. The defendant, who worked at a hotel, unlocked a hotel room door for a couple who were drunk. At some point, defendant had sexual contact with the woman while the man slept. Defendant said the sexual contact was consensual. The video evidence contradicted the timeline the defendant described. The majority concluded the record evidence was not sufficient to find that defense counsel didn't review or did not understand the significance of the video evidence, and the failure to call the defendant as a witness did not prove ineffective assistance as a matter of law. So to make a sufficient record, a 440 motion would be necessary. In the words of the court, "The lack of an adequate record bars review on direct appeal wherever the record falls short of establishing conclusively the merit of the defendant's claim. Here, it is essential that an appellate attack on the effectiveness of counsel be bottomed on an evidentiary exploration by collateral or post-conviction proceeding brought under Criminal Procedure Law 440.10. Next is People v. Goondall, G-O-O-N-D-A-L-L, pages 17 and 18. It raises the ineffective assistance issue. It also raises an identification issue. Second Department, reversing defendant's conviction, held defendant didn't receive effective assistance of counsel. During the trial, the victim of the robbery twice misidentified the defendant before identifying him, first indicating he did not see the defendant in the courtroom, and then indicating a spectator was the assailant. Defense counsel pursued the misidentification defense throughout the trial, successfully challenging the admission of a surveillance video. But in summation, defense counsel essentially conceded that defendant was one of the assailants. And then the other issue had to do with the validity of the identification. Second Department noted that a witness who participated in a procedurally defective pretrial identification procedure may still identify the defendant at trial if the people demonstrate the in-court identification is based upon the witness's independent observation of the defendant, here observations made during the robbery itself. The court wrote, a witness may identify the perpetrator of a crime as part of his or her in-court testimony, notwithstanding the existence of a procedurally defective pretrial identification procedure, provided the people establish by clear and convincing evidence the in-court identification is based upon the witness's independent observation of the defendant, here, contrary to the defendant's contention, at an independent source hearing, the prosecution proved by clear and convincing evidence the complainant's in-court identification of the defendant would be based on his independent observations during the robbery. And then with respect to the ineffective assistance, the court wrote, defense counsel's confused and contradictory actions, effectively conceding the dispositive issue, deprived the defendant of his right to effective assistance of counsel. Given defense counsel's opening statement and his conduct throughout the course of the trial in advancing his misidentification defense, his decision to abandon his chosen defense midstream in favor of a nebulous and contradictory argument that no forcible taking of property had occurred was so unreasonable, inconsistent, and devoid of any possibility of success that it does not even rise to the level of a trial strategy. Under the circumstances, the defendant was deprived of the effective assistance of counsel and is entitled to a new trial. Next is People v. Edwards on pages 18 and 19. It's an ineffective assistance case and a right to counsel case. Fourth Department, reversing defendant's conviction and ordering a new trial, held that defendant's complaints about his assigned counsel were sufficient to warrant further inquiry by the court. The court wrote, at a pretrial appearance, defendant requested that the court assign him new counsel because, among other things, defense counsel had failed to file discovery demands and omnibus motions. After defendant's request, defense counsel erroneously stated, those were filed already, and the court stated, I have them here, I'm holding them in my hand. However, the people concede that although certain discovery demands were served on the people, defense counsel never filed any omnibus motions. The court never conducted an inquiry into defendant's serious complaint that defense counsel failed to file any omnibus motions and instead proceeded under the mistaken belief that they had been filed. Although the court might well have found upon limited inquiry that defendant's request was without genuine basis, it could not so summarily dismiss that request based on a mistaken belief that omnibus motions had been filed. Therefore, we conclude that the court violated defendant's right to counsel by failing to make a minimal inquiry concerning a serious complaint, and we therefore reverse the judgment and grant a new trial. People v. Jones on page 19 raises a similar ineffective assistance issue. The Fourth Department, vacating defendant's guilty plea, held defendant should have been given the opportunity to explain his reasons for requesting a new attorney. The court wrote, during the plea colloquy, defendant attempted to inform the court that he was pleading guilty only because he was not receiving effective assistance of counsel. Although vague and conclusory complaints about counsel generally are insufficient to trigger the court's duty to make an inquiry, the court here failed to provide defendant with an opportunity to explain his complaints. The court refused to accept defendant's pro se letter regarding the matter and did not otherwise allow defendant to expand upon his claim of ineffective assistance of counsel. Defendant's request may well have been a frivolous delaying tactic. Nevertheless, we conclude that the court had no basis to completely cut off the discussion without hearing any explanation. A defendant must at least be given the opportunity to state the basis for his application. Next, on page 20, People v. Nitschmann, another ineffective assistance case, 3rd Department, reversing county court, held that the court should have held a hearing to determine whether defendant was informed of a plea offer by defense counsel. Defendant argued the failure to inform him of the plea offer, which was more lenient than the offer to which he pled, constituted ineffective assistance of counsel. The court wrote, there's no dispute that the people made a pre-indictment plea offer more lenient than the one that defendant later accepted, an offer that the people presumably extended in a fair and honest manner and believed would pass muster with county court, and that the offer was rejected and withdrawn. Defendant averred that he did not know about this offer and would have accepted it. Next is People v. Marshall on page 21. It's another ineffective assistance case involving a conflict of interest. 3rd Department held the judge did not adequately inform defendant of the risks of continuing to be represented by defense counsel in the plea proceedings after defense counsel and the judge had been informed of a conflict of interest should the matter go to trial. Several persons who would be called as witnesses by the people were former or current clients of defense counsel. The court wrote, once informed of the conflict, county court had a duty to inquire whether defendant understood the risks of defense counsel's continued representation and, knowing those risks, was choosing to waive the conflict. However, the court didn't make such an inquiry. The court merely informed defendant while simultaneously reiterating the plea agreement that defense counsel had secured for him that defense counsel would probably have a conflict if the matter continued. Therefore, defense counsel's conflicted representation of defendant, absent a proper and informed waiver, deprived defendant of his right to the effective assistance of counsel. Next is People v. Gregory on pages 21 and 22. It's out of the Court of Appeals, and it deals with a defendant's request to proceed without counsel. The Court of Appeals, affirming defendant's conviction, held that the defendant's request to proceed pro se was properly denied. The court wrote, the trial court concluded, based upon, among other things, its own observations of defendant's conduct throughout these lengthy proceedings and the testimony of defendant's attending physician, that defendant engaged in malingering insofar as he was competent to proceed but persisted in his efforts to avoid trial. Inasmuch as defendant engaged in conduct which would prevent the fair and orderly exposition of the issues, we conclude that the trial court did not abuse its discretion in denying defendant's request to go pro se. Next is People v. Henrique on pages 22 and 23. It has to do with the integrity of the grand jury proceedings. 3rd Department, reversing county court, held on the people's appeal, the integrity of the grand jury was not affected by the prosecutor's alleged failure to inquire about the potential bias of a grand juror. One of the grand jurors was a teacher, and defendant had been his student 10 years before. The court wrote, the record discloses that one of the grand jurors knew one of the testifying witnesses. The grand juror, who used to be a teacher and had been retired for 10 years, stated that the witness was a former student and that he had not seen the witness since the student left his class. The grand juror was then asked whether there was anything else that would affect his ability to be fair and impartial, to which he responded no. In our view, the relationship between the grand juror and the witness was not a close relationship so as to give rise to the possibility of prejudice. Furthermore, although the prosecutor's voir dire of the grand juror was brief, we are satisfied that based upon his unequivocal response, the grand juror's impartiality was not compromised. Next is People v. Mendoza on pages 23 and 24. It's out of the Court of Appeals. It's an ineffective assistance case, but it raises the issue of jury nullification. Court of Appeals held defendant was not deprived of effective assistance of counsel because counsel effectively conceded defendant stole items from the lobby of an apartment building. Defense counsel argued defendant was overcharged. He was charged with burglary because, although defendant had no right to be in the lobby, there was no break-in and the stolen items were of minimal value. The Court of Appeals noted that it has been held a defendant cannot argue jury nullification to a jury. The court wrote, in People v. Weinberg, we concluded that defendant's argument that he should have been permitted by the trial court to present the concept of jury nullification during summation is foreclosed by our holding in People v. Goetz. Relying on Goetz, we explained that permitting defense counsel instead to encourage the jury to abdicate its primary function would directly contravene the trial court's authority, recognized in Goetz, to instruct the jury that they must follow and properly apply the law. Then the court went on, we can't say on this record, when viewed in totality, defendant was provided with less than meaningful representation. Defense counsel was eminently familiar with the facts of the case and the evidence elicited, including the details of the surveillance video and the photographic exhibits. Given the truly overwhelming evidence against his client on all the charges and constrained by the limited legitimate defense strategies available, counsel raised what he reasonably perceived could be factual issues in the case, such as the method of defendant's entry into the building. Counsel's performance included cogent opening and closing arguments, a motion to dismiss after the people's case in chief, and thorough cross-examinations of the people's witnesses. The trial court did not curb counsel's jury nullification summation arguments. As a result, the whole record of counsel's performance demonstrates that defendant has failed to sustain his burden. He was deprived of meaningful representation. Next is People v. Bloodworth on page 24. It's another ineffective assistance case, this time dealing with the calculation of the speedy trial statute. Fourth Department, vacating defendant's guilty plea, held defense counsel was ineffective because defendant was entitled to dismissal of the indictment pursuant to the speedy trial statute. Defense counsel was aware of the correct dates, but only argued defendant was deprived of his constitutional right to a speedy trial and did not correct county court's erroneous time calculation. The court wrote, although defense counsel set forth the pertinent facts of the commencement of the action and defendant's arraignment, at which time the people announced their readiness for trial, he failed to argue that the relevant period exceeded 6 months and was a clear violation of defendant's statutory speedy trial rights. Instead, defense counsel focused on the constitutional speedy trial claim. At oral argument of the motion, the court addressed the statutory speedy trial claim, set forth the pertinent dates, and then stated that according to its calculation, without specifically crunching the numbers, but by estimates, this is a period of 5 months and 7 days. After addressing the circumstances of the superseding indictment and the constitutional speedy trial claim, the court asked defense counsel if there were any facts that would be pertinent that it did not recite in discussing the matter. Instead of pointing out the court's erroneous calculation of the statutory speedy trial period, defense counsel said, I think my motion was essentially based on 30.20 constitutional speedy trial. Next, on page 25, People v. Ouellette, out of the Court of Appeals. It's a Brady material case. Court of Appeals, in a full opinion by Judge Garcia, reversing the appellate division, held the people's failure to turn over to the defense a surveillance video, which captured people, but not the defendant, present at the time the victim was shot, as well as the victim falling, required a new trial. The prosecutor had seen the video and considered it irrelevant. In her summation, the prosecutor said that there was no video of the incident. The court wrote, "It requires no frame-by-frame review to grasp that the video would have become the focal point of defendant's trial. It would have set the scene of the murder, identified other potential witnesses, served to impeach eyewitness testimony, and provided a basis for an argument that other suspects might have been involved in the shooting. Instead of playing that role at trial, the video was withheld from the defense, and the jury was told it didn't exist. The aggregate effect of the suppression of this evidence undermines confidence in the verdict, and therefore defendant is entitled to a new trial." Next is People v. Giucca. It's on pages 26 and 27. It's another Brady case out of the Court of Appeals. In a full opinion by Judge DiFiore, the Court of Appeals, over a dissent and reversing the appellate division, held defendant's motion to vacate his conviction based upon the people's failure to turn over Brady material, which was relevant to the impeachment of a key witness, and it was also relevant to the prosecutor's failure to correct that witness's testimony, should not have been granted. That motion to vacate should not have been granted on those grounds. In a nutshell, the Court of Appeals held that any Brady violation that might have occurred in light of the extensive impeachment evidence forcefully used by defense counsel was not material in that it could not have affected the verdict. The court wrote, "Defendant brought a CPL 440.10 motion to vacate his conviction. Defendant asserted that the people had violated their Brady obligation by failing to turn over evidence that there was an agreement to confer a benefit on the witness, referred to as J.A., in exchange for his testimony at defendant's murder trial. In addition, defendant asserted that the trial prosecutor personally intervened in that witness's burglary case by procuring his release without bail during a June 13th drug court appearance and failed to correct, and further that the prosecutor failed to correct the witnesses, that's J.A.'s characterization of his performance in the drug program as being good. And the court went on, "In determining that a Brady violation occurred, the appellate division failed to do the required materiality analysis as to the suppressed information. To say that there was ample impeachment evidence at trial against the witness on multiple levels is an understatement. There's no reasonable possibility that the knowledge that the trial prosecutor was the specific ADA who stood up for the people at the June 13th appearance and that J.A., the witness, was still in a drug program despite additional program violations would have changed the jury's verdict. So because the evidence which was not disclosed would not have changed the verdict, it was deemed not to be material, and therefore its omission was not reversible error." Next is People v. Durant. It's on page 27. It has to do with character evidence, specifically negative character evidence. The Second Department held the negative character evidence was properly stricken. Negative character evidence, that being that the witness never heard that the defendant acted in a sexually inappropriate or sexually abusive way in the workplace, is admissible if it relates to the appropriate community. Here, the community the witness was testifying about was the workplace, which was not the relevant community because the alleged sexual misconduct with a child occurred in secret and outside the workplace. The court said, "Contrary to the conclusion of the Supreme Court, negative evidence of reputation, that is that the witness never heard anyone say anything negative about the defendant, can constitute relevant character evidence. However, relevant character evidence must be of reputation generally in the community where the crime occurred. Although that community is more broadly defined in modern times, the defendant's reputation in the workplace for lack of sexual impropriety was in no way relevant to whether he sexually abused a child in secret and outside of the workplace. Accordingly, the character evidence was properly stricken since the evidence was irrelevant. Next is People v. Santiago on page 28. It discusses a surprising definition of constructive possession, and it also discusses an identification issue. The First Department, in a full opinion by Justice Tom, held defendant was properly convicted of constructive possession of property taken during a mugging, even though the defendant, although present, did not participate in the mugging and was acquitted of the robbery. The First Department further held that the victim was properly allowed to identify the defendant at trial despite the suppression of the show-up identification. The defendant was convicted on the theory that he constructively possessed the stolen property, which apparently was found in the locked boiler room of a garage where he and the other two men were found hiding by the police. The court wrote, "The people established by clear and convincing evidence the defendant had a basis for her in-court identification of defendant independent of a previously suppressed show-up procedure. A number of factors support the independent source finding, even when viewed in the light of modern scientific knowledge regarding identifications. The victim had an unobstructive view of defendant and the other two perpetrators under good lighting at close range and had sufficient time to observe them while she was being attacked." And turning to the constructive possession issue, the court said, "Defendant's presence, his hiding in an oily sump pit inside with the two robbers, and his attempt to physically resist detention compelled the conclusion that defendant manifested a consciousness of guilt. Police testimony thus clearly established that defendant had been a participant in the criminal venture and that he exercised dominion and control over the room where the perpetrators were essentially trapped in close proximity to the stolen property, and thereby exercised dominion and control over, and thus joint constructive possession, of the property itself." So just to reiterate, here three people mugged the victim and went into hiding in a parking garage. They went into the boiler room of the parking garage and locked the door, and the police found them in some kind of a sump pit inside the boiler room, inside the parking garage, with the stolen items. This would appear to be an extension or a loosening of the constructive possession criteria. Constructive possession usually involves the concept of exercising dominion and control over the area where the items are found. Here, the stolen items were in the boiler room of a parking garage, and there was no evidence that the defendant had ever been in that space before. Next is People v. Ellis. It deals with the correction law and sex offenders, a court of appeals case. The Court of Appeals, in a full opinion by Judge Fahey, affirming the appellate division, held defendant, a sex offender, did not violate the correction law by failing to disclose his Facebook account. The Facebook account was not an internet identifier, which must be disclosed under the correction law. The court wrote, "The appellate division correctly concluded that Facebook is not an internet identifier, and that the existence of a Facebook account, as opposed to the internet identifiers a sex offender may use to access Facebook or interact with others on Facebook, need not be disclosed to the Division of Criminal Justice Services pursuant to Correction Law Section 168-F, Subdivision 4. As the people concede, this was the legal theory upon which the indictment was based. The indictment, therefore, accuses defendant of performing acts that simply do not constitute a crime and is jurisdictionally defective. Next is a matter of McNerlin. It's on pages 29 and 30, has to do with double jeopardy. Fourth Department held that the test for double jeopardy under the state constitution is the same as under the federal constitution. The court wrote, under the federal constitution, double jeopardy arises only upon separate prosecutions arising out of the same offense. The United States Supreme Court employs a same elements test, also known as the Blockberger test, which refers to Blockberger versus U.S. 284 U.S. 299. It's a 1932 case that inquires whether each offense contains an element not contained in the other. If not, they are the same offense, and double jeopardy bars additional punishment and successive prosecution. Here the elements of DWI, which was Vehicle and Traffic Law Section 1192, Subdivision 2, Subdivision 3, and leaving the scene of a property damage incident without reporting, which is Section 600, Subdivision 1A, are not the same. Among other things, a person does not need to be intoxicated to be found guilty of leaving the scene of a property damage incident without reporting, and does not need to cause property damage to be found guilty of DWI. The Court of Appeals has held that double jeopardy clauses in the state and federal constitutions are nearly identically worded, and we have never suggested that state constitutional double jeopardy protection differs from its federal counterpart. The Court of Appeals set forth the Blockberger test, not the same conduct test, when analyzing a defendant's claim that the double jeopardy clauses of both the federal and state constitutions barred a subsequent prosecution. We therefore conclude that the constitutional double jeopardy analysis is the same under federal and state law, and that there is no constitutional double jeopardy violation in this case. Next is People v. Paris on pages 30 and 31. It's a depraved indifference murder case. The Fourth Department held that a 2003 murder, depraved indifference murder conviction, must be reversed because the case was on appeal when the law of depraved indifference murder was clarified to exclude the intentional murder of a single victim with a weapon. The court wrote, we conclude that the evidence establishes that defendant accosted decedent who was leaving a grocery store. Defendant, who told police investigators he had been informed that decedent had been sent by another man to injure defendant, confronted decedent, grabbed him by either his clothing or by a gold necklace that he was wearing, and dragged him across the street. A friend of decedent's attempted to intervene at some point, at which time defendant displayed a weapon and attempted to shoot the friend, but the gun didn't fire. Defendant struck decedent in the face with the handgun, and decedent's friend ran to his car and drove it toward the location where defendant was with decedent. Defendant then fired the weapon approximately 8 times. At least 6 of those shots hit the decedent, including 2 shots that entered his back and 2 shots hit the car that decedent's friend was driving. In his motion for a trial order of dismissal with respect to the count of depraved indifference murder, defense counsel argued that defendant's conduct was intentional or it was nothing at all. If this isn't intentional, I don't know what is. That was a quote from the defense counsel. Thus, the issue raised on this de novo appeal was presented to the Supreme Court and is therefore preserved for our review. Although defendant was convicted before the Court of Appeals decided People v. Feingold, which is 7 New York 3rd, 288, 2006 case, which definitively stated for the first time that the depraved indifference element of depraved indifference murder is a culpable mental state rather than the circumstances under which the killing is committed, the people correctly concede that the Feingold standard applies to this appeal inasmuch as defendant's direct appeal was pending when Feingold was decided. Next is matter of Irina K. on page 31. It's a family offense case. The First Department held the evidence supported harassment second, but did not support one count of sexual misconduct, assault in the second degree, or criminal obstruction of breathing or blood circulation. Petitioner admitted that she expected payment for sex and did not demonstrate a lack of consent with respect to one of the sexual misconduct counts. Biting petitioner's ear during sex did not constitute assault second, with teeth being a dangerous instrument, and restricting petitioner's breathing during sex was not a crime because respondent stopped immediately when petitioner expressed discomfort. With respect to harassment, the court wrote, the record shows that respondent threatened petitioner that he would take the steps necessary to cause her to lose her immigration status and rights to the child if she stopped prostituting herself to him, thereby evincing respondent's intent to harass and alarm petitioner. That's Penal Law Section 240.26, Subdivision 3, and his inducing petitioner to engage in a sexual relationship with him by instilling fear. And this case was in the context of a family offense. Next is matter of Rohrbach. It's on page 32. It's another family offense case. Fourth Department held the portion of the family offense petition which charged harassment in the second degree was properly dismissed because it did not allege all the elements of the offense. The court wrote, a person commits harassment in the second degree under Penal Law Section 240.26, Subdivision 3, when he or she, with intent to harass, annoy, or alarm another person, engages in a course of conduct or repeatedly commits acts which alarm or seriously annoy such other person and which serve no legitimate purpose. Thus, to be viable under the circumstances here, the petition was required to allege that respondent engaged in a course of conduct that did alarm or seriously annoy petitioner and the conduct served no legitimate purpose. Although the petition before us accuses respondent of engaging in a course of conduct that annoyed and alarmed petitioner, nowhere does it allege that respondent's alleged course of conduct served no legitimate purpose. That's Section 240.26, Subdivision 3. Therefore, the petition does not adequately plead an allegation that respondent committed harassment in the second degree under Section 240.26, Subdivision 3, and the court properly dismissed the petition to that extent. Next is People v. Folk on pages 32 and 33. It has to do with the impeachment of a people's witness by the people. And it also deals with past recollection recorded. The First Department, reversing defendant's conviction, held that admitting the grand jury testimony of a witness was reversible error. The witness's testimony at trial that he couldn't remember the events was not so damaging to the people's case as to justify impeachment. The court wrote, the people concede that the trial court erred in admitting the grand jury testimony of a witness indicating that defendant fired an errant shot that struck a bystander as defendant and a companion fled from another group following a verbal altercation. Specifically, the people acknowledge that the testimony was not admissible under the past recollection recorded exception to the hearsay rule because the witness did not testify at trial that the grand jury testimony correctly represented his knowledge and recollection when made. And it was not admissible for impeachment purposes under Criminal Procedure Law Section 60.35 because the witness's trial testimony that he could not remember the relevant facts did not affirmatively damage the case of the party calling him. In this case, that party was the people. Next is People versus Cook on page 33. It's an identification case. First Department, reversing defendant's conviction, held the defendant should have been allowed to present evidence that one of the robbery victims, who didn't testify, failed to identify the defendant at a lineup. Even though there was evidence the victim falsely claimed he or she could not identify anyone. The court wrote, "The court erred in denying defendant's application expressly made under Chambers versus Mississippi, which is 410 U.S. 284, to receive testimony that one of the robbery victims who was unavailable to testify at trial failed to identify defendant at a lineup. Of the requirements for admission of exculpatory hearsay evidence, the only one in dispute is the reliability of the non-identification. Although there were reasons to suspect that this victim may have falsely claimed to be unable to identify anyone in the lineup, the non-identification plainly bore sufficient indicia of reliability under the applicable standard, which hinges upon reliability rather than credibility. Where the proponent of the statement is able to establish this possibility of trustworthiness, it is the function of the jury alone to determine whether the declaration is sufficient to create reasonable doubt of guilt." Next is People versus Jones. It's another identification case. Second Department, reversing defendant's conviction for one of two robberies, determined the pretrial identification of the defendant by the robbery victim, Fisher, should have been suppressed. The people were given a cell phone found at the robbery scene. The robber had used a taser in the Fisher robbery. In the cell phone was a photo of a man using a taser on a person. Fisher told the police the man in the photo using a taser was the man who robbed him. Fisher subsequently identified the defendant in a photo array. Even though Fisher's in-court identification of defendant was deemed admissible, the suppression error was not harmless. The court wrote, "The procedure employed by the detective in showing Fisher the cell phone videos was a police-arranged identification procedure, even though the police did not arrange the content of the videos on the phone. The procedure by which Fisher viewed the videos occurred at the deliberate direction of the state and not as a result of mere happenstance. The people failed to meet their initial burden of establishing the reasonableness of the police conduct and the lack of any undue suggestiveness created by the video identification procedure. By showing Fisher the cell phone and telling him that the phone was recovered from the scene of the robbery, the detective suggested that the phone may belong to one of the perpetrators of the robbery. One of the videos portrayed an individual using a taser on someone else, which was similar to Fisher's description of the circumstances of the robbery. Fisher identified the defendant's photograph in a photo array only after he was shown the video. Further, contrary to the people's contention, it cannot be said that the video did not single out or portray the individual with the laser in a negative light. The video portrayed the individual committing a violent criminal act against another person. Accordingly, the court should have suppressed the video identification on the ground that the identification procedure was unduly suggestive." Next is People versus Folks, which is on page 35. It has to do with polling the jury. Second Department held the trial judge properly handled a juror's hesitation when the jury was polled. Outside the presence of the jury, the judge asked the juror about his reasons for hesitation, determined it was not caused by improper pressure, and sent the jury back for more deliberations. The court wrote, "Here the court appropriately conducted an inquiry outside the other jurors' presence into why juror number 2 hesitated in affirming the verdict, and further obtained clarification as to the reasons he gave. Juror number 2's responses clarified that the pressure he perceived did not arise out of matters extraneous to the jury's deliberations or not properly within their scope. Further, his responses established that the verdict was not the product of actual or threatened physical harm. Accordingly, we agree with the court's determination to instruct the jury to continue deliberating. Next is People v. McIntosh on page 36. It's out of the Court of Appeals. It has to do with jury instructions. The Court of Appeals held denying a request for the jury to be instructed on lesser-included offenses in this murder case was harmless error. The court wrote, even assuming the court erred in denying defendant's request to submit the crimes of manslaughter in the second degree and criminally negligent homicide to the jury as lesser-included offenses of the charged crimes of murder in the second degree and manslaughter in the first degree, the error was harmless. The appellate division properly concluded that defendant's conviction of the lesser inclusory count of first-degree manslaughter, which it dismissed as required by CPL 300.40 subdivision 3B, did not change the harmless error analysis. Under the circumstances presented here, the jury's guilty verdict on the indictment's highest count, despite the availability of the next lesser-included offense for their consideration, forecloses defendant's challenge to the court's refusal to charge the remote lesser-included offenses because it dispels any speculation as to whether the jury might have reached a guilty verdict on still lower degrees of homicide. Next is People v. Almonte on pages 36 and 37. It's another Court of Appeals case. It deals with two issues, jury instructions and lesser-included offenses, and the admission of a 911 call as an excited utterance. The Court of Appeals, over an extensive dissenting opinion, as well as another brief dissenting opinion, held the denial of defendant's request for a jury instruction on the lesser-included offense of assault third and the admission of a 911 call as an excited utterance was harmless error. The court wrote, defendant failed to show that there was a reasonable view of the evidence in the particular case that would support a finding that he committed the lesser-included offense, but not the greater. Although in determining whether such a reasonable view exists, the evidence must be viewed in the light most favorable to the defendant, charging the lesser-included offense here would have forced the jury to resort to sheer speculation. And with respect to the 911 call, Court of Appeals said, nor does Supreme Court's admission of the call between the victim and the 911 operator require reversal. A spontaneous declaration or excited utterance made contemporaneously or immediately after a startling event, which asserts the circumstances of that occasion as observed by the declarant, is an exception to the prohibition on hearsay. The test is whether the utterance was made before there has been time to contrive and misrepresent. That is, while the nervous excitement may be supposed still to dominate and the reflective power to be yet in abeyance, assuming without deciding that it was error to admit the 911 call, any such error would have been harmless. The facts of this case, the Almonte case, which deals with a lesser included offense and the admissibility of a 911 call, were not laid out in the majority opinion. They were only laid out in the dissent. So if you're interested in the facts, they're in the dissent of that case. Again, it's People v. Almonte. At this point, I'm going to insert the first verification code for this June 2019 Criminal Law Update CLE course. The first verification code is 911. Again, the first verification code for this June 2019 Criminal Law Update CLE course is 911. Next is People v. Henry on pages 38 and 39. It deals with three issues, the judge's obligation to communicate the contents of jury notes, the attorney-client privilege, and a sentencing issue. Third Department held, one, because there was no record of the judge's discussion of a jury note with counsel, the murder conviction, the only count to which the jury note was relevant, must be reversed. Two, although defendant's girlfriend was defendant's agent for the purpose of delivering defendant's letter, which was mailed to her, to his attorney, there was evidence defendant authorized his girlfriend's mother to read the letter. Therefore, the attorney-client privilege was lost. And three, the unauthorized use of a vehicle charge has the same actus reus as the robbery and grand larceny charges. Therefore, the sentence for unauthorized use of a vehicle cannot run consecutively with the sentences for robbery and grand larceny, but it can run concurrently to the sentences for burglary and criminal possession of stolen property. The court wrote, given the court's statement to the jury that it had an off-the-record conversation with counsel regarding the jury note, it would not be unreasonable to believe that county court had informed counsel of the note's precise contents. However, the record contains no specific indication that the court provided counsel with the precise content of the note before it delivered its response to the jury, nor was the note read verbatim on the record before the response was given. Therefore, the record fails to establish that counsel had the opportunity to participate in the formation of the court's response to the jury's substantive inquiry. And with respect to the letter given to the defendant's girlfriend and the attorney-client privilege, the court wrote, we conclude that defendant's girlfriend was acting as defendant's agent. Therefore, whether the letter was protected by the attorney-client privilege turns on whether defendant had a reasonable expectation of confidentiality when he sent it to her. There was contradictory evidence regarding whether defendant authorized her to share a copy of the letter with her mother, which county court resolved by determining defendant had authorized disclosure to her mother. The determination that defendant specifically authorized disclosure of the letter to a third party, that being his girlfriend's mother, established that defendant had no reasonable expectation of confidentiality and therefore defeated the attorney-client privilege. Therefore, county court did not err in admitting the letter. Next is People v. Carlin on pages 40 and 41. It deals with the legal sufficiency of evidence presented to the grand jury. Third Department, in an appeal by the people, affirmed county court's dismissal of the indictment because there was legally insufficient evidence that the substance involved was cocaine. The court wrote, the evidence presented to the grand jury consisted of sparse testimony from the confidential informant and an investigator involved in the controlled transactions, with most of the substance of that testimony having been supplied through leading questions. As to the first transaction, the confidential informant testified in a conclusory manner that he believed the substance to be crack cocaine without providing any description of the substance or explanation for his belief. And with respect to the second transaction, the confidential informant did not express any belief as to the nature of the substance he received from defendant. Additionally, although the investigator testified that he received white chunky substances from the confidential informant, his testimony surrounding the testing of those substances was sorely lacking. He did not provide any detail as to his training and experience in field testing, explain how field testing occurs, or specifically identify what he did in this case to determine that both substances were cocaine. Next, we're skipping down to People v. Smith on pages 42 and 43. It's out of the Court of Appeals, and it clarified the burdens of proof in demonstrating the need for a missing witness charge. The Court of Appeals, reversing defendant's conviction, reversing the appellate division, in a full opinion by Judge Feinman, held that the trial court's analysis of the defense request for a missing witness jury instruction improperly shifted the burden to the defendant to show that the testimony would not be cumulative. The witness, named Dees, was with the shooting victim and was shot himself. The witness was the first to see the shooter in a car that passed by and tried to push the shooter away when the shooter approached. The court wrote, in Gonzales, 68 New York 2nd 424, we established the analytical framework for deciding a request for a missing witness instruction. The proponent initially must demonstrate only three things via a prompt request for the charge. 1. That there is an uncalled witness believed to be knowledgeable about a material issue pending in the case. 2. That such witness can be expected to testify favorably to the opposing party. And 3. That such party has failed to call the witness to testify. The party opposing the charge can defeat the initial showing by accounting for the witness's absence or demonstrating that the charge would not be appropriate. This burden can be met by demonstrating, among other things, that the testimony would be cumulative to other evidence. If the party opposing the charge meets its burden by rebutting the prima facie showing, the proponent retains the ultimate burden to show that the charge would be appropriate. We have repeatedly reiterated Gonzalez's specific burden-shifting analysis, but we have never required the proponent of a missing witness charge to negate cumulativeness to meet its prima facie burden. Given that defendant, as the proponent of the missing witness charge, met his initial burden, the people were required to rebut that showing by establishing why the charge was inappropriate. They failed to do so. The people simply asserted without explanation that Deese's testimony on the issue of identification would be cumulative because there's absolutely no indication that Deese would be able to provide anything that wasn't provided by the victim. This conclusory argument was insufficient to satisfy the people's burden in response to defendant's prima facie showing. Deese's testimony would not have been trivial or cumulative due to inconsistencies in the victim's descriptions of the incident and what the shooter was wearing. The issue of identification was in sharp dispute, and the testimony of the only additional person who was present during the shooting might have made the difference. Next is People v. Truluck on pages 42, 43 and 44. It has to do with the proof necessary to demonstrate an assault on a police officer, specifically whether the injured officer was engaged in a lawful duty at the time of the assault. Second Department reversed defendant's assault conviction. Defendant and his brother were sitting on an elevated subway grate when they were approached by two police officers. Defendant's brother became angry, telling one of the officers to leave him alone and yelling. Defendant restrained his brother, telling him to calm down. At some point, defendant suddenly punched one of the police officers. The jury was instructed that to find the defendant guilty of a violation of Penal Law 120.05, Subdivision 3, the injured police officer must have been engaged in a lawful duty at the time of the assault. The definition of lawful duty provided to the jury included a heavier burden of proof to which the people must be held because there was no objection to the instruction. Pursuant to the law as provided to the jury, defendant's assault conviction was against the weight of the evidence. The court wrote, "The consistent testimony of the two police officers shows that they were not in the process of arresting the defendant when the assault occurred. Moreover, while the trial evidence establishes that the defendant's brother was yelling profanities at the female officer and displaying irate behavior, neither of the officers testified that they intended at any time to arrest the defendant's brother for any offense, or were attempting to do so at the time of the assault. Under these circumstances, and particularly in light of the highly specific supplemental charge given by the trial court on the meaning of lawful duty, the evidence was factually insufficient to prove that the female officer was engaged in a lawful duty, as that term was defined to the jury by the Supreme Court at the time of the assault by the defendant." With respect to what the jury instructions were, the Second Department wrote, "In its instructions to the jury, Supreme Court did not initially define the term lawful duty. During deliberations, the jury asked the court to explain what the female officer's lawful duty was at the time of the assault by the defendant. With the consent of both parties, the court instructed the jury that a peace officer or police officer acting pursuant to his or her special duties may arrest a person for any offense when he or she has reasonable cause to believe that such person has committed such offense in his or her presence, and a crime when he or she has reasonable cause to believe that such person has committed such crime, whether in his or her presence or otherwise. Since the people failed to register any objection to the Supreme Court's supplemental charge, they were bound to satisfy the heavier burden of proof contained in the charge. Next is People v. Stanford, which is on page 44. It has to do with what the parole board may consider when making a ruling on a petitioner's eligibility for parole. Third Department, affirming the denial of release on parole, noted that the parole board may properly consider remorse and insight into the offense, even though those factors are not listed in the controlling statute. The court wrote, petitioner argues that the board improperly questioned him regarding both what caused him to commit the crimes and why he initially failed to accept responsibility, resulting in the two young victims having to testify in court against him. While the board may not consider factors outside the scope of the applicable statute, it can consider factors such as remorse and insight into the offense that are not enumerated in the statute, but nonetheless relevant to an assessment of whether an inmate presents a danger to the community. As the board's questions challenged by petitioner were aimed at petitioner's remorse, his acceptance of responsibility, and insight into the crimes, they were not improper and did not deprive petitioner of a fair hearing. Next is Matter of Torres, on pages 44 and 45. It's another parole case. Third Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the administrative appeal of the denial of parole was tainted by inaccurate information about the offenses committed by the defendant. The court wrote, the claim asserted by petitioner is preserved as it could not have been raised upon administrative appeal. Specifically, petitioner challenges the fact that the administrative appeals unit relied upon inaccurate information regarding his criminal history in affirming the board's denial of parole. A review of the statement by the appeals unit inaccurately reported that petitioner murdered 6 as opposed to 4 people. Because of the likelihood that such error may have affected the decision to affirm the board's denial of petitioner's request for parole, proper administrative review is required. Next is Matter of Campbell on pages 45 and 46, another parole case. Second Department held the denial of parole to petitioner who, in 1990, had killed a 15-year-old classmate and the 17-month-old child she was babysitting was not irrational. Although petitioner had made strong rehabilitative and educational efforts, the parole board properly considered all the relevant factors and did not make their decision on the basis of the seriousness of the offense alone. The court wrote, we note that the literature in the record indicates that the effects of encephalitis could include a lack of awareness and sensitivity and a lack of warmth and empathy. We further note that the parole board found that the petitioner appealed to have a disconnect and that his remorse was shallow. Nevertheless, the interview record and the text of the subject determination established that the requisite statutory factors were properly considered, and the record does not support the conclusion that the parole board's determination evinces irrationality bordering on impropriety. Contrary to the petitioner's contention, the parole board considered the petitioner's youth and its attendant characteristics in relationship to the commission of the crimes at issue, and did not base its determination solely upon the seriousness of the offenses. In addition, the interview transcript indicates that the parole board took into account a number of other factors that reflected well on the petitioner, but determined that these factors did not outweigh the factors that militated against granting parole. The parole board was not required to give each factor equal weight and was entitled to place greater emphasis on the severity of the petitioner's crimes. Next is People versus Johnson on pages 46 and 47. It deals with the proof necessary to demonstrate a violation of probation. In this case, the court found that the proof was insufficient. Third Department, reversing county court, held defendant was not properly notified of alleged violations of probation, and the proof did not support a finding defendant violated a condition of probation. The court wrote, where a violation of probation is alleged to have occurred, a written statement must be filed with the court and provided to the defendant, setting forth the condition or conditions of the sentence violated and a reasonable description of the time, place, and manner in which the violation occurred. And that's Criminal Procedure Law 410.70, Subdivision 2. Here, the details of the alleged violations in the Uniform Court Report only included that defendant violated Condition 2, which required her to obey all state and federal laws, by engaging in conduct that led to her September 2015 and March 2016 arrests. Although a different section of the Uniform Court Report summarizing defendant's probation supervision referenced other incidents that county court made findings with respect to, the Uniform Court Report only alleged that defendant violated Condition 2 of the terms of her probation. Moreover, defendant's probation officer acknowledged in her testimony that defendant was not charged in the Uniform Court Report with violating other conditions, specifically Conditions 8, 12, and 16, notwithstanding the testimony that was allowed at the hearing with regard to those conditions. Defendant was not provided with a written statement informing her that she was also being charged with violating those conditions of her probation. Accordingly, county court's finding that defendant violated those terms of her probation was improper. Condition 2 of the terms of defendant's probation required her to obey all federal, state, and local laws and notify her probation officer immediately if questioned or arrested by a law enforcement agency or if convicted of a new offense. In support of its allegation that defendant violated this condition, the people adduced the testimony of defendant's probation officer, who testified that defendant notified her of both the September 2015 and March 2016 arrests and charges. Beyond the probation officer's testimony that defendant had been arrested on two occasions, no additional evidence or proof was offered as to the underlying acts. Accordingly, county court's finding that defendant violated Condition 2 of her probation was not supported by a preponderance of the evidence. Next is People v. Castaneda, or Castaneda. It's on page 47, another probation violation case. Also has an appellate issue. The Fourth Department noted that defendant's argument that the conditions of his probation were illegal survived a waiver of appeal and the failure to preserve the error. The court wrote, defendant contends that the court imposed several unlawful conditions of probation. Initially, we note that defendant's contentions are not encompassed by the valid waiver of the right to appeal because they are based on challenges to the legality of the sentence. Additionally, although defendant failed to preserve those contentions for our review, there is a narrow exception to the preservation rule permitting appellate review when a sentence's illegality is readily discernible from the trial record, and that exception encompasses a contention that a probation condition is unlawful because it is not reasonably related to rehabilitation or is outside the authority of the court to impose. We conclude that inasmuch as defendant's challenges to the conditions of probation here implicate the legality of defendant's sentence, and any illegality is evident on the face of the record, those claims are not barred by defendant's failure to preserve them. With respect to the merits, the people correctly concede that the court erred in barring defendant from all use of the Internet. The statute provides that a sentencing court may require that the defendant comply with a reasonable limitation on his or her use of the Internet, provided that the court shall not prohibit such sentenced offender from using the Internet in connection with education, lawful employment, or search for lawful employment. Next is People v. Morris on page 48. It has to do with late notice of the intent to introduce psychiatric evidence. Second Department, reversing defendant's conviction, held county court abused its discretion by not allowing defendant to serve a late notice of his intent to offer psychiatric evidence. The court wrote, here the record indicates that the trial court failed to exercise any discretion over whether to permit the defendant to serve late notice of his intent to offer psychiatric evidence. Exercising our own discretion, we conclude that under the particular circumstances of this case, the defendant should have been granted permission to serve the late notice, and the people's preclusion motion should have been denied. The evidence that the defendant previously had suffered auditory hallucinations had high probative value to corroborate the defendant's testimony that he entered the home with the intent to aid a woman who was yelling rather than to damage the house. Further, the preclusion of testimony regarding those portions of the defendant's conversation with the responding officer which involved his past auditory hallucinations and his resultant hospitalization deprived the jury of the full context of the interaction. Any prejudice to the people was substantially outweighed by the defendant's extremely strong interest in presenting the evidence. Next is People v. Harris on pages 49 and 50. It has to do with the validity of a search incident to arrest after the defendant had been handcuffed. First Department, in a full opinion by Justice Weber, over an extensive two-justice dissenting opinion, held that the search of a suitcase was a valid search incident to arrest, even though defendant, who had let go of the suitcase, had been handcuffed. Defendant had been observed by the arresting officer named Ayala coming out of several stores and placing apparently stolen items into the suitcase. At the time the suitcase was searched, defendant was handcuffed and he had been approached on the street by approximately 8 police officers. The court wrote, the testimony of Officer Ayala established that the suitcase was not in the exclusive control of the police at the time of the search. It remained at defendant's feet where he dropped it. Additionally, it has been consistently held that whether in fact defendant could have had access to the briefcase at the moment it was being searched is irrelevant. That defendant was handcuffed in no way negates a finding of exigent circumstances justifying a warrantless search. Although defendant was handcuffed during the search of the suitcase, there was a realistic possibility that he could have used means other than his hands, such as kicking and shoving the arresting officer to disrupt the arrest process in order to gain a weapon or destroy evidence. Next is People v. Malloy on page 50, Court of Appeals case dealing with consecutive sentences. The Court of Appeals, affirming defendant's conviction, noted that the consecutive sentences for possession of a weapon and murder were supported by the facts. The court wrote, so long as a defendant knowingly, unlawfully possesses a loaded firearm before forming the intent to cause a crime with that weapon, the possessory of crime has already been completed and the consecutive sentencing is permissible. Here, the record supports Supreme Court's imposition of consecutive sentences. Video surveillance evidence showed defendant in possession of the gun several minutes before approaching the victim, supporting the conclusion that defendant possessed the weapon for a sufficient period of time before forming the specific intent to kill. Thus, consecutive sentencing was permissible. Next is People v. Antonio J. on page 51, has to do with the special sentencing requirements for juvenile offenders. Fourth Department held, because defendant is a juvenile offender, the surcharge and crime victim assistance fee must be vacated, and the two consecutive 2 to 6 year sentences were illegal. The court wrote, the people correctly concede in each appeal that the surcharge and crime victim assistance fee must be vacated because defendant is a juvenile offender, citing Penal Law Section 60, Subdivision 2, and 60.10. We therefore modify the adjudication in each appeal accordingly. The people further correctly concede in each appeal that the aggregate duration of the two consecutive sentences, that being 2 to 6 years, is illegal, citing Penal Law Section 60.02, Subdivision 2, 70, Subdivision 2E, and Subdivision 3B, and that defendant's challenge to the illegal sentence in each appeal survives his waiver of his right to appeal and does not require preservation. Next is People v. Reed on page 52. It's another sentencing case. Fourth Department held the consecutive sentences for the sale of small amounts of cocaine was unduly harsh and imposed concurrent sentences. The defendant had been promised concurrent sentences of 4 years prior to trial. After trial, consecutive 7-year sentences were imposed. The court wrote, "The crimes at issue involve sales of small amounts of cocaine, and the record contains no indication that defendant is a large-scale drug dealer. Although prior to trial, the court had agreed that if defendant pleaded guilty, it would impose a sentence of 4 years incarceration on each count to run concurrent with each other. After the trial, the court imposed determinate terms of 7 years incarceration plus 2 years post-release supervision on each count to run consecutively to each other." Next is People v. Cutler on pages 52 and 53. It involves the issue of sentencing in absentia. Third Department, vacating the defendant's sentence, held defendant should not have been sentenced in absentia. The court wrote, "Defendant had a waivable right to be present at sentencing, and he was indisputably informed of that right and of the consequences for failing to appear, including the fact that the proceedings would go forward in his absence. Nevertheless, before proceeding in the absence of a defendant who fails to appear, the court must conduct an inquiry into the reason for the absence and consider whether the defendant could be located within a reasonable period of time. County court did not make that inquiry and indeed rejected defense counsel's request for an adjournment to look into the reasons for defendant's absence. Therefore, county court erred in sentencing defendant in absentia." Next is People v. Richardson on page 53. It deals with several issues: sentencing, the relationship between sentencing and a plea agreement, right to counsel, guilty pleas, and appeals. Fourth Department held that restitution should not have been ordered because it was not part of the plea agreement. The court went on to note that defendant's argument he was deprived of his right to counsel with respect to his decision to testify before the grand jury was not forfeited by his guilty plea, but was encompassed by his waiver of appeal. The Fourth Department declined to follow a Third Department decision, which held a deprivation of counsel argument survives a waiver of appeal, irrespective of whether the deprivation infected the guilty plea. Here, defendant did not assert that the alleged deprivation of his right to counsel infected the plea bargaining process or tainted the voluntariness of his plea. The court wrote, "Defendant's further contention that county court erred in ordering him to pay restitution because restitution was not part of the plea agreement survives both his guilty plea and his unchallenged waiver of the right to appeal. Contrary to the people's contention, defendant preserved his contention for appellate review by objecting to the imposition of restitution on the same ground he now advances. On the merits, it's undisputed that the plea bargain did not include restitution, and the court therefore erred in awarding restitution without affording defendant the opportunity to withdraw his plea." Next is People v. Simpson on page 54. It deals with an illegal sentence and the ability to deal with that on appeal. The Fourth Department noted that where a defendant is not sentenced as a predicate felon, the minimum sentence is 1/3 of the maximum, not 1/2 of the maximum. The court wrote, "We note that the court imposed an illegal sentence of 3.5 to 7 years imprisonment on defendant's conviction for criminal possession of a weapon in the third degree. Because defendant was not sentenced as a predicate felon, the minimum period of her indeterminate sentence on this conviction must be 1/3 of the maximum period, not 1/2 as fixed by the court," and it cites Penal Law Section 70, Subdivision 3B. Although the issue was not raised by either party, we cannot allow illegal sentence to stand. We therefore modify the judgment by reducing defendant's sentence on that count to an indeterminate term of 2.5 to 7 years imprisonment. Next is People v. Hunter on pages 54 and 55. It deals with, it's another sentencing issue, this time dealing with the Parker warnings. Third Department, reversing county court, held the Parker warnings, notifying defendant of the enhanced sentencing consequences of his misconduct between the plea and the sentencing, were inadequate, and defendant's counsel was ineffective for not raising the issue. Defendant's sentence was 5 years longer than the sentence promised at the time of the plea because he was rearrested. The Parker warnings did not clearly inform defendant his sentence would be enhanced if he was rearrested. The failure to preserve the error was excused because of the ineffective assistance. The court wrote, counsel was ineffective for failing to challenge the enhanced sentence on the ground that county court did not ensure the defendant was fully aware of the consequences of being rearrested prior to sentencing. A successful challenge to the enhanced sentence would have resulted in county court having to either impose the agreed-upon sentence or provide defendant with an opportunity to withdraw his plea. Next is People v. Skyers, which is on pages 55 and 56. Third Department, it's another sentencing case. The Third Department, reversing defendant's conviction by guilty plea, held defendant's statements at sentencing, indicating that he was intoxicated at the time he committed the crime, which was assault, required further inquiry by the court. The Third Department noted that the issue constitutes an exception to the preservation requirement. The court wrote, the statements made by defendant at sentencing, which raised the possibility of an intoxication defense and called into question the intent element of assault in the first degree, were sufficient to trigger the narrow exception to the preservation requirement, thereby imposing a duty of further inquiry upon county court to ensure that defendant's guilty plea was knowing and voluntary. Defendant did not say anything during the course of the plea colloquy that suggested a possible intoxication defense, and defendant's statement at sentencing contradicted his sworn admissions during the plea colloquy. However, statements made by a defendant that negate an element of the crime to which a plea has been entered raise the possibility of a particular defense or otherwise suggest an involuntary plea, require the trial court to then conduct a further inquiry or give the defendant an opportunity to withdraw the plea. County court did not pursue either of those two avenues. Next is People v. Ramirez, which is on page 57. Another sentencing case, this time involving youthful offenders. Second Department, vacating the sentence and sending the matter back because the court did not consider whether defendant should be afforded youthful offender status, noted that a valid waiver of appeal would not bar raising this issue on appeal. The court wrote, CPL 720.20 subdivision 1 requires that the sentencing court must determine whether an eligible defendant is to be treated as a youthful offender, even where the defendant fails to request such treatment or agrees to forego it as part of a plea agreement. Contrary to the people's contention, the defendant's waiver of his right to appeal was invalid because the Supreme Court failed to confirm that the defendant understood the nature of the right to appeal and the consequences of waiving it. In any event, a valid waiver would not bar the defendant's contention that the court failed to consider youthful offender treatment. Next is People v. Colon on page 58. It's another sentencing case involving youthful offenders. Third Department held Supreme Court did not follow the correct procedure with respect to whether the defendant should be afforded youthful offender status. Although the defendant pled guilty to an armed felony, which can render him ineligible for youthful offender status, the court was required to consider the factors which would render him eligible despite the armed felony and to do so on the record. The court wrote, the Court of Appeals has held that when a defendant has been convicted of an armed felony, and the only barrier to his or her youthful offender eligibility is that conviction, the court is required to determine on the record whether the defendant is an eligible youth by considering the presence or absence of the factors set forth in CPL 720.10 subdivision 3. The court must make such a determination on the record, even where the defendant has failed to ask to be treated as a youthful offender or has purported to waive his or her right to make such a request pursuant to a plea bargain. If the court determines that the offender is not an eligible youth, the inquiry is at an end. However, if the court determines that the defendant is an eligible youth based on the presence of one or more of the CPL 720.10 subdivision 3 factors, the court then must exercise its discretion a second time to determine whether the eligible youth should be granted youthful offender treatment pursuant to that statute. The record before us does not conclusively establish that Supreme Court reached a determination as required by the statute regarding defendant's eligibility for youthful offender treatment in the first instance. The court made no mention of the factors set forth in the statute, and instead of determining defendant's eligibility for youthful offender treatment pursuant to the statute, appears to have moved to the second step and determined that youthful offender treatment was inappropriate. Next is People v. Powell on page 59. It has to do with the Sex Offender Registration Act, the risk assessment. The Second Department determined that the Supreme Court should have considered defendant's application for a downward departure and remitted the matter. The court wrote, Supreme Court is required to make a determination with respect to a defendant's risk level 30 calendar days prior to discharge, parole, or release. That's Correction Law Section 168-N. As part of its determination with respect to a defendant's risk level, the court may depart downwardly from the presumptive risk level. A defendant seeking a downward departure from the presumptive risk level has the initial burden of 1. Identifying, as a matter of law, an appropriate mitigating factor, namely a factor which tends to establish a lower likelihood of reoffense or danger to the community, and is of a kind or to a degree that is otherwise not adequately taken into account by the SORA guidelines, and 2. Establishing the facts in support of its existence by a preponderance of the evidence. If the defendant makes that twofold showing, the court must exercise its discretion by weighing the mitigating factor to determine whether the totality of the circumstances warrants a departure to avoid an overassessment of defendant's dangerousness and risk of sexual recidivism. As the people correctly concede, Supreme Court should not have denied defendant's application for a downward departure as premature, but instead should have addressed the merits of the application. Next is People v. Geddes on page 60. It has to do with the defendant's right to be present during a sidebar conference. It also briefly mentions the presence of a therapy dog in the courtroom. The Fourth Department, reversing defendant's conviction, held defendant did not waive his right to be present when a prospective juror told the judge and attorneys that she was not sure she had completely answered a voir dire question. Defendant was not in the courtroom when the judge asked defense counsel if he wanted his client present, and defense counsel said he was okay with it. The juror then said that her son was a convicted felon. The Fourth Department also held that upon retrial, an adult witness should not be allowed to testify accompanied by a therapy dog. The court wrote, initially, we conclude that the situation at issue here constituted a material stage of the trial, inasmuch as the prospective juror volunteered information about her son's status as a convicted felon. This information was relevant to a question asked earlier during the voir dire. That question was, have any of you or anyone close to you been a victim of a crime, a witness to a crime, been accused of a crime, or participated in any way in a criminal proceeding? That question was intended to be relevant to potential bias. We further conclude that under the circumstances of this case, defendant did not waive his right to be present. Here, without defendant being physically present in the courtroom, and with counsel simply stating to the court, I'm okay with his absence, we perceive no basis to conclude that there was either an implicit or explicit waiver. Defendant's absence from the courtroom when the prospective juror raised the issue of potential bias made it impossible for him to knowingly and voluntarily waive his right to be present. Next is People v. Morris on page 61. It has to do with the suppression of statements, dealing with Miranda rights, controlled phone call, and whether the defendant was in custody. The Fourth Department, on an appeal by the people in this child sexual contact case, held defendant's statement made during a controlled phone conversation with the mother of the child should not have been suppressed. The Fourth Department further found that statements made by the defendant during interrogation at the sheriff's office should not have been suppressed because the defendant wasn't in custody at the time of the interrogation. The court wrote, "We conclude that the mother did not make a threat or a promise that would create a substantial risk that defendant might falsely incriminate himself. We further conclude that the controlled call did not constitute an unconstitutionally coercive police tactic, nor were the tactics employed by the mother during the call unconstitutionally coercive," citing Criminal Procedure Law 60.45. "And deceptive police stratagems in securing a statement need not result in involuntariness without some showing that the deception was so fundamentally unfair as to deny due process, or that a promise or threat was made that could induce a false confession. Although defendant's interview occurred at the sheriff's office, that fact does not necessarily mean that he is to be considered in custody. Defendant voluntarily agreed to meet the investigators at the sheriff's office and arranged for his own transportation to and from the interview. When defendant arrived, the investigators informed him that he was free to leave. In fact, defendant left the sheriff's office at the conclusion of the interview, despite making inculpatory statements. Further, defendant was not restrained during the interview, and the door to the interview room was unlocked. Although the investigators confronted defendant with the statements he made during the controlled call, the fact that the questioning may have turned accusatory in nature did not render the interview custodial, given the other circumstances present in this case." Next is People v. Tucker on page 62. It's another case involving the suppression of statements. Fourth Department held the defendant's answer to the investigators asking where defendant resided, for which no CPL 71030 notice was provided, was not pedigree information and should not have been admitted in evidence. The drug possession charge was founded on constructive possession. Therefore, asking defendant where he resided was designed to elicit an incriminating response. The error was deemed harmless in this case, however. The court wrote, "Defendant contends that the court erred in admitting in evidence an oral statement of defendant regarding his address for which no 71030 notice had been given. The statement at issue was defendant's response to a question about where he resided, and it was made to one of the principal investigators who had executed a search warrant at the home of defendant's parents. As the people correctly concede, defendant's statement regarding his address was not pedigree information for which no 71030 notice was required, because, under the circumstances of this case, the investigator's question was likely to elicit an incriminating admission and had a necessary connection to an essential element of the possessory crime charged. The court thus erred in admitting the statement in evidence in the absence of a 71030 notice." Next is People v. McDonald, which is on page 63. It's another case involving statements and the issue of whether defendant was in custody. Fourth Department held defendant, although handcuffed and seated on the back seat of a police car, was not in custody, such that his answers to questions, including whether he had anything to drink, should be suppressed. The officer observed defendant commit several traffic infractions, then the defendant got out of the car staggering. The defendant would not stop and go back to his car when the officer told him to. When the officer caught up to him, he smelled alcohol. The officer then handcuffed the defendant and had him sit on the back seat of the police car with his feet outside the car on the ground. The court wrote, "Contrary to defendant's contention, we conclude that his answers to the sergeant's questions were not the product of custodial interrogation requiring Miranda warnings. It is well established that not every forcible detention constitutes an arrest. And under the circumstances noted above, we agree with the court that the sergeant's use of handcuffs did not transform the detention into a de facto arrest. Rather, the sergeant's use of the handcuffs to effect the detention was warranted in light of the threat the defendant might take additional evasive action. We further conclude that seating defendant on the back seat of the police car did not transform the sergeant's questioning into custodial interrogation. The sergeant lawfully, although forcibly, detained defendant for investigatory purposes based on his observation of defendant committing several traffic infractions. Given defendant's visible intoxication, staggering gait, and prior evasive actions, a less intrusive means of fulfilling the police investigation than seating defendant partially in the police car was not readily apparent. The sergeant's action fell short of the level of intrusion upon defendant's liberty and privacy that constitutes an arrest. In addition, the sergeant's questions were investigatory rather than custodial in nature." Next is People v. Wager on pages 64 and 65. It has to do with the definition of a motor vehicle. It's a vehicular manslaughter case. Third Department dismissed certain counts of the indictment which stemmed from an accident involving an all-terrain vehicle called an ATV. A passenger in the ATV, which was driven by defendant, was thrown from the ATV and killed. Defendant was alleged to have been driving while intoxicated and was convicted of vehicular manslaughter in the first degree, vehicular manslaughter in the second degree, aggravated driving while intoxicated, and driving while intoxicated. The Third Department held that one of the first-degree vehicular manslaughter counts must be dismissed because ATVs are not motor vehicles within the meaning of the statute, and that's Penal Law 125.13, Subdivision 1. The court also found that three concurrent inclusory counts must be dismissed. The court wrote, "We are constrained to conclude that ATVs are not motor vehicles for purposes of the penal law. Accordingly, the weight of the evidence does not support defendant's conviction for vehicular manslaughter in the first degree under Penal Law Section 125.13, Subdivision 1. Next is People v. Pettiford on pages 65 and 66. It has to do with a street stop and the DeBoer criteria. Fourth Department held the blocking of the car in which defendant was a passenger by parking at the entrance to the driveway was only a permissible level 2 intrusion. The court wrote, "The charges against defendant arose after the police, who were investigating a recent stabbing, encountered defendant in a vehicle matching the description and anticipated location of the stabbing suspect's vehicle given in a police dispatch. We conclude that the police conduct was justified in its inception and at every subsequent stage of the encounter leading to defendant's arrest. Contrary to defendant's contention, the police action in pulling up behind the subject vehicle, which had parked in defendant's driveway after passing the officer's patrol car, constituted only a level 2 intrusion, despite the fact that a police vehicle blocked the subject vehicle's egress from the driveway. The police at that point had the requisite founded suspicion to justify a level 2 intrusion." Next is People v. Green on pages 66 and 67. It's another street stop case involving the DeBoer criteria. Fourth Department held that although the suppression court determined the police officer had a founded suspicion of criminality when he ordered defendant out of the car, a founded suspicion of criminality did not justify ordering the defendant to place his hands on the patrol car in preparation for a pat-down search. However, the officer testified he smelled marijuana, which would justify the search. Because the court did not rule out that issue, the matter was sent back for a ruling on it. The court wrote, "Because the driver pulled over of his own volition before the officer activated his emergency lights to initiate a traffic stop, the officer needed only an articulable basis to lawfully approach the occupants of the vehicle and request information. That basis was supplied by the officer's observation that the vehicle was being operated in violation of the vehicle and traffic law. Thus, the officer's conduct was justified in its inception. The court determined that the officer had a founded suspicion of criminality prior to ordering defendant to exit the vehicle for the pat search. A founded suspicion of criminality standing alone, however, was insufficient to justify the officer's conduct in ordering defendant to place his hands on the patrol car in preparation for a pat search. Nevertheless, in making its determination, the court credited the officer's testimony that he smelled fresh marijuana emanating from the vehicle and was experienced in detecting marijuana. It is well settled that the odor of marijuana emanating from a vehicle, when detected by an officer qualified by training and experience to recognize it, is sufficient to constitute probable cause to search a vehicle and its occupants. Next is People v. Partridge on page 67. It has to do with the sufficiency of evidence, in this case, the evidence of the age of the victim in a sexual assault case. The Fourth Department reversing defendant's conviction for predatory sexual assault against a child found that the people did not present evidence to support the assaults occurred before the victim turned 13 or during a period of less than 3 months, the statutory criteria. The court wrote, without narrowing the time frame, it is entirely possible that the testified to instances of sexual conduct that allegedly occurred at the residence happened before the statute's effective date or after the victim turned 13 years old. The people also failed to establish that the criminal conduct occurred over a period of time not less than 3 months in duration. And it cites Penal Law 130.96 and 130.75, Subdivision 1. In short, there were no markers in the evidence at trial about when the conduct occurred that would allow the jury to conclude that defendant committed predatory sexual assault against a child at the relevant time. Next is People v. Berman, which is on page 68. It's another sufficiency of evidence issue relating to the age of the victim. Fourth Department held that the statute which criminalizes a younger person's causing injury to a person 65 or older does not require proof the attacker knew the victim is 65 or older. The court wrote, contrary to defendant's contention, nothing in the statutory text requires that the actor know the age of the injured person. Rather, by providing that the defendant must act with intent to cause physical injury to a person who is 65 years of age or older, and must cause such injury to such person, the statute simply requires that the person whom the actor intentionally injures be, as a matter of fact, 65 years of age or older. That's Penal Law Section 120.05, Subdivision 12. That reading is consistent with the pattern criminal jury instructions, which provide that the people must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that with respect to the age element, the injured person was 65 years of age or older at the time of the crime. Next is People v. Jones on pages 68 and 69. It has to do with the jurisdictional requirements for a superior court information. Third Department, reversing defendant's conviction, held the superior court information to which defendant pled guilty was jurisdictionally defective because it didn't include the time of the offense. The error survives the guilty plea and waiver of appeal and is not subject to the preservation requirement. The court wrote, the people concede and we agree that the waiver of indictment is invalid and the superior court information is jurisdictionally defective for failure to set forth the approximate time of the offense in accordance with Criminal Procedure Law 195.20. At this point, I'm going to insert the second verification code to be placed on your attorney affirmation. This is for the June 2019 Criminal Law Update CLE course. The second verification code is AGE. Again, the second verification code for this June 2019 Criminal Law Update CLE course is age. Next is People v. Eggleston. It's on page 70. Again, deals with the jurisdictional requirements for a superior court information. The third department, reversing county court and dismissing the superior court information, held the information was an improper vehicle for defendant's guilty plea because the grand jury had already handed down an indictment. In addition, the superior court information was jurisdictionally defective because it did not include the original charge or a lesser included offense. The court wrote, Criminal Procedure Law 195.10 Subdivision 2B provides that a defendant may waive indictment and consent to be prosecuted by a superior court information in the appropriate superior court at any time prior to the filing of an indictment by the grand jury. However, waiver of indictment attempted after a grand jury actually indicts is generally invalid under CPL 195.10 Subdivision 2B because the plain words of the statute require a waiver be made prior to the filing of an indictment. It is well settled that the general purpose and objectives of constitutional and statutory boundaries with respect to the waiver of indictment are to permit a defendant to go directly to trial without waiting for a grand jury to hand up an indictment, thereby affording a defendant the opportunity for a speedier disposition of charges and eliminating unnecessary grand jury proceedings. When the grand jury has already acted and those motivations are no longer present, waiver of indictment is not authorized, even where a defendant has consented to the devised procedure. Here, an indictment had been filed to which defendant pleaded guilty prior to defendant agreeing to be prosecuted by way of a superior court information. Although the indictment was subsequently dismissed, the dismissal was not due to any defect requiring such dismissal, and it cites CPL 210.20. County court did not authorize resubmission of the charge to the grand jury, and it cites CPL 210.45 subdivision 9, and a new felony complaint was never filed. Therefore, defendant was not placed on a formal pre-indictment procedure track. In the final case in this June 2019 Criminal Law Update CLE is People v. Hale on page 71. It has to do with the admissibility of grand jury testimony where there has been intimidation of the witness by the defendant. The Fourth Department held county court properly determined defendant pressured a witness to refuse to testify at trial. Therefore, the witness's grand jury testimony was properly admitted in evidence. The court wrote, defendant contends that county court erred in determining, following a Sirar hearing, that the people presented clear and convincing evidence that defendant wrongfully made use of his relationship with the victim in order to pressure her to violate her duty to testify. The people presented evidence that the missing witness was ready and willing to testify while defendant was in jail during the grand jury proceedings, but became reluctant after defendant was released and the trial date drew closer. Days prior to the trial, the witness's mother observed the witness leave with defendant and their child for several hours. When the witness returned to the mother's home, the witness started talking about the subpoena she had received, started saying things like, they can't do anything to me if I don't show up. The subpoena wasn't properly served. There's nothing that they can do if I don't show up to court. Things of that nature. The mother reported to the prosecutor that she had never heard the witness use legal terminology like that before. Defendant's relative also observed the witness in defendant's home during the time in which law enforcement officers were attempting to locate her on a material witness warrant. Further, although the prosecution never informed the witness of the updated trial schedule following the witness's failure to appear, the witness appeared at court 2 days after the Sirar hearing at the perfect moment to save defendant from the impending admission of her damning grand jury testimony. And that concludes this CLE course, the June 2019 Criminal Law Update CLE, which is based on the New York State appellate decisions that were summarized on the New York Appellate Digest website in June of 2019 and thereafter compiled into an update pamphlet.